To fizzle out during the afternoon. There should be some pleasant spells of afternoon sunshine, but a chilly wind, a high of 9 degrees Celsius. And for Scotland, a similar tale. Showers first thing, particularly in the north and west, fizzling out through the afternoon. Best of the sunshine throughout the day for the borders. Highs for Scotland 8 or 9.
Thank you very much, Susan. Now, Book of the Week, and more missives to and from a president. It's the early 1960s and the race for space has intensified. Questions about Vietnam loom at this time too. But there are lighter moments to witness, mainly to do with what a president might be worth in dollars in The Letters of John F. Kennedy.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
John Kennedy delivered more quotable and compelling speeches than any other American president, aside from Abraham Lincoln. None was more surprising than the address he made to Congress on May 25, 1961. It was in this speech that Kennedy announced he would be holding his first face-to-face meeting with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev later that spring. But the address will always be remembered for the astounding proposal he laid before the legislators of landing a man on the moon. Congress was as alarmed as Kennedy at the Russians sending Yuri Gagarin rocketing into space to make an orbit of the Earth. They reacted to the president's statement with thunderous applause. They even cheered when he told them his Man on the Moon project would over the next 5 years require a budget of between $7 and $9 billion. The vast majority of letters Kennedy received about the space program were highly positive. A number actually contained monetary donations to the effort. One can only speculate about Kennedy's reaction to the size of the donation sent by an Oregon state legislator and his wife. "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Howard," wrote Kennedy's assistant, "thank you for your donation of $4.30 for the space program. Your check will be forwarded to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration for their use in the space programs under their jurisdiction. Sincerely, T.J. Reardon, Jr." The Kennedy wit and humor, which became trademarks of his presidency, were evident in the exchange of letters between him and his friend Leonard Lyons, the popular New York columnist. In late August 1961, Lyons passed the window of an autograph shop, which contained a display of presidential autographs, along with the price each signature was fetching.
"Dear Mr. President, in the event you might be anxious about how you rate in history, I think you should know about this market. George Washington sells for $175. U.S. Grant sells for $55. Franklin D. Roosevelt's for $75. Teddy Roosevelt's for $67.50. John F. Kennedy's for $75. Please don't bother to acknowledge this for two reasons. One, you're too busy, and two, if you sign your name too often, that would depress the autograph market on East 53rd Street. Sylvia joins me, of course, in sending you fondest regards. Sincerely, Leonard."
The White House, Washington, D.C. "Dear Leonard, I appreciate your letter about the market on Kennedy signatures. It is hard to believe that the going price is so high now. In order not to depress the market any further, I will not sign this letter. Best regards."
Delighted by Kennedy's response, Lyons wrote back, asking the president's permission to share it with his readers.
"I assume that your reply, one way or another, will be signed. Now that you know about the market, I hope you don't think I am seeking unjust enrichment. As a swap, therefore, I'm enclosing two Republican autographs, Tom Dewey's and Richard Nixon's. Not that one of your autographs isn't worth two of theirs. It's just that yours will be signed Jack, and theirs are signed in full. With best regards, sincerely, Leonard.
By using his press secretary, Pierre Salinger, to grant Lyons permission to print the letter, Kennedy made sure he delivered the last word in the exchange. Salinger wrote, "Dear Leonard, with regard to your letter of October 16th, you have permission to print the President's response. By having me write this letter, the President has again avoided signing the letter. Best regards, Pierre Salinger, Press Secretary to the President." In that summer of 1961, author-journalist Theodore H. White, who in 1960 published The Making of the President, set off on a trip to Southeast Asia. White had lived and worked in China throughout the 1930s and early 40s, and was disturbed by what he encountered in Vietnam. When he returned to the United States, White, who had become a friend of Kennedy's while writing his book, sent the President a 14-page letter in which he candidly described the situation as he saw it. Following is an excerpt from that letter.
"The situation gets worse almost week by week. The guerrillas now control almost all the southern delta, so much so that I could find no American who would drive me outside Saigon in his car even by day without military convoy. There is a political breakdown here of formidable proportions. If we mean to win, perhaps we must do more. But what? If there is another coup against Diem by his army, should we support it? If there is no natural coup and we are convinced that Diem is useless, should we incubate one? If we feel bound by honor not to pull or support a coup, shall we lay it on the line to Diem and intervene directly? Or should we get the hell out and make another line or policy elsewhere? What perplexes the hell out of me is that the commies on their side seem to be able to find people willing to die for their cause. I find it discouraging to spend a night in a Saigon nightclub full of young fellows of 20 and 25 dancing and jitterbugging, while 20 miles away, their communist contemporaries are terrorizing the countryside."
Kennedy's agonizing over what course to take in Vietnam was exacerbated by the ineffectiveness and blatant corruption of the Diem government and the specter of Soviet military intervention on behalf of the North Vietnamese. In early November 1961, Kennedy received a letter from the Soviet chairman Nikita Khrushchev.
"How can one support a man like Ngo Dinh Diem, with his bloody regime, who completely lost the respect of the people, sending troops to suppress national liberation movement in other countries, is by no means a way that corresponds to the interests of peace? And besides, what are the guarantees that the American troops would not get tied up in South Vietnam?"
In March 1962, with the debate escalating over what the extent of American involvement in Vietnam should be, Kennedy received a secret letter from John Kenneth Galbraith, now U.S. ambassador to India. Galbraith was more than ever one of Kennedy's most trusted advisors. Stating that he was aware of Kennedy's distaste for diagnosis without remedy, Galbraith presented what he believed American policy should be, accompanied by warnings that would later prove tragically prophetic.
"New Delhi, India, March 2nd, 1962. Secret. I continue to be sadly out of step with the establishment. I can't think Diem has made any significant effort to improve his government, either politically or administratively, or will. We are increasingly replacing the French as the colonial military force, and we will increasingly arouse the resentments associated therewith. Moreover, while I don't think the Russians are clever enough to fix it that way, we are surely playing their game. They couldn't be more pleased than to have us spend our billions in these distant jungles where it does us no good and them no harm. Incidentally, who is the man in your administration who decides what countries are strategic? I would like to have his name and address and ask him what is so important about this real estate in the space age. What strength do we gain from an alliance with an incompetent government and a people who are so largely indifferent to their own salvation? Some of his decisions puzzle me. However this may be, and knowing your distaste for diagnosis without remedy, let me lay down four rules that should govern our policy in this part of the world. They are: 1. Keep up the threshold against the commitment of American combat forces. This is of the utmost importance. A few will mean more and more and more. And then the South Vietnamese boys will go back to the farms. We will do the fighting. 2. Keep civilian control in Saigon. Once the military take over, we will have no possibility of working out a disentanglement. 3. We must keep the door wide open for any kind of a political settlement. In particular, we must keep communications open by way of the Indians and even the Russians to Hanoi. If they give any indication of willingness to settle, we should jump at the chance. Politics is not the art of the possible. It consists in choosing between the disastrous and the unpalatable. I wonder if those who talk of a 10-year war really know what they are saying in terms of American attitudes. We are not as forgiving as the French. 4. Finally, I hold to the view, whatever our public expressions, that any alternative to Diem is bound to be an improvement. I think I mentioned once before that no one ever sees an alternative to the man in power. But when the man in power is on the way down, anything is better. Yours faithfully, John Kenneth Galbraith.
Kennedy's dilemma about the course of action he should take haunted him until the day of his assassination. Would he have pursued the disastrous course taken by his successors, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon? Or after his re-election, would he have withdrawn all American forces from that troubled region? What would Kennedy have done remains possibly the greatest of all what-if questions in the history of foreign policy.
Colin Stinson was narrating The Letters of John F. Kennedy, edited by Martin W. Sandler. Other voices were Trevor White and Stephen Greif. Richard Lang was John Kennedy. The producer was Duncan Minchell, and tomorrow, further insight into relations with Nikita Khrushchev. And Radio 4's Kennedy season continues this weekend when Stacey Keach stars in a tense new drama by Christopher Lee. Air Force One imagines what really happened in the hospital and aboard the presidential jet immediately after John F. Kennedy's assassination. It explores theories based on diaries, statements and classified research, a mix of substantiated and contested documentation. Martin Jarvis directs a starry American cast in Air Force One by Christopher Lee this weekend's Saturday drama at 2:30. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today Thursday the 14th of November. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Humber, Thames, Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, low southwest Iceland 984, expected North Norwegian Sea 986 by 1800 Thursday. New high expected just west of Fitzroy 1042 by the same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking North Utsira, South Utsira. Southerly, veering northwesterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8.